This episode of the Antlers and Hicks podcast is brought to you by Bloodline Custom Calls. I've been a fan of Bloodline Custom Calls for several years now. I've gotten in touch and gotten a good friendship with Jason Cooper and the boys over at Bloodline, and they make some of the best turkey calls I've heard. They also have some outstanding merchandise, so go check them out. BloodlineCustomCalls.com, Facebook, and Instagram. Check out Bloodline Custom Calls. I'm telling you, you won't be disappointed. If you guys are like me, you're already putting out your trail cameras, gathering information, and finding out when these deer are actually going to be moving so that when the opening day of bow season comes in, you're ready to roll. Well, I got a full-time job, I got a family, and I'm trying to get this podcast off the ground, so my time is kind of limited. Enter the Wise Eye Smart Cam from Wise Eye Technology. Man, this camera is the legit camera on the market right now, and I'm going to tell you why. It's because it takes the guesswork out of patterning these deer. What it does is when the camera takes a picture, it's just like any other cell cam, it's going to take a picture and send it to you, but it goes through hunt control. It uses hunt control. Now, what is hunt control? Hunt control, basically, when the picture is sent to hunt control, it has a GPS in there that tells hunt control where the picture was taken. Hunt control then gathers the data of the weather and the time of day, and it starts pinpointing and breaking down all this information on when these animals were moving so that you can start patterning future activity. That's right. Takes all the guesswork out of you having to figure out, okay, well, what was the weather like this day? And, well, what was the time of day? No, all that's taken out. Hunt Control does that for you. It is a very, very nice system. It's not just a trail camera. It's a complete hunting package. Go check them out yourself, wiseeyetech.com. That's wise eye, like your eyeball, tech, like the university.com. Wiseeyetech.com, go check them out. Also, you can buy them on the Hogfathers website, hogfathers.com. That's hog with two G's, in the digital outdoor store on Amazon. Now look, guys, I'm telling you, these cameras are impressive. Go check them out. You're really going to like what you see. So before we get started with the podcast, I want to remind you guys, September the 15th, the North Monroe Baptist Church is having a huge sportsman's banquet. Man, this thing is going to be nice. We're going to be raising money for outside missions. Got a lot of stuff to raffle off. Going to have a trip to Africa, all kind of hunting gear. You know, I'm going to be there anyway, so I told the guys, you know, hey, you mind if I bring my scoring gear? And we'll just tell anybody that wants to bring a whitetail up there, bring it. I'll be scoring for the Buckmaster Whitetail Trophy records. And like I said in one of my posts the other day, man, I don't care if it's your kid's first 6-point or if it's your granddaddy's deer from 1968. If you've never had it scored, bring it. I'm telling you, we will sit down. I may even bring my podcast gear. So come on in. Tickets are $50. Get with me if you need a ticket. I can tell you how to get tickets. Just send me a message on Facebook, and we will get this going. Again, September the 15th, at doors open at 5:30, and then the dinner starts at 6:30 at North Monroe Baptist Church. Also, guys, go to my Facebook page, check out my outdoor gear, my caps, my shirts, rep the brand. Caps are $25 in person, $30 shipped, and shirts are going to be $20 in person and $25 shipped. So let's hear from Glenn Harris. You know, Mr. Glenn, you are to me the voice and the words of the outdoors in North Louisiana.
Well, thank you for saying that, Greg. It's been a long time coming, you know, to kind of build up to that point, but it's just an honor for me to get to do what I do.
Yes, sir. Yes. So how long have you been doing it?
My column last week indicated that I just celebrated 50 years of having an outdoor column.
50 years?
50 years.
My goodness gracious. Have you seen a lot change in this area, in the outdoors in those 50 years?
Oh, yeah. Could you tell me how it all started?
Tell me how. From Genesis. Give it to me.
From Genesis. No revelation. Genesis. I lived in Homer. And I had kind of become a fan of reading some of these outlaws, especially Gris Gresham, because that was the, you know, he was a friend of my daddy, and he was from Nicholas Parish like I was. And I just would read his stuff, and I thought, gosh, that must be something. So one day, Greg, I sat down, and I wrote a story. And when I got through with that story, I was thinking, good gosh almighty, what have I created here? So I said, I'm going to write Gris Gresham and just see if he can maybe suggest which one of the big three magazines might want most. I don't want them fighting over it, you know, but... So I had the nerve or the ignorance or whatever to send the column to Gris Gresham. Never, you know, what surprised me is that he responded. And I was kind of let down. No, I wasn't kind of let down. I was real let down because Gris said, I think you might have a little trouble placing this column. But if you're interested in being a writer, it's just... You got to, and I remember, still remember the phrase he used, you got to hone your craft. You got to, just like any other job or anything else you do, you've got to work at it and just improve and find out all you can about it. So after that bit of discouragement, a few years later, I was living in Homer, and I walked into the weekly newspaper, the Guardian Journal there in Homer, and I was nervous. And I asked the lady who was the editor then, Ms. Hightower, I said, I'd kind of like to write a hunting and fishing column for the paper. I didn't even know to call it outdoor column. And she smiled, looked at me, said, I don't think so. And you know what my reaction was?
What's that?
Relief. I thought, Lord, if she told me I had to do it, I don't know if I could have done it. 6 months later, I was in there, and she said, you still want to write that column? I said, yeah. So I started in September of 1972, September 21st, I believe, and I had my first column published. And I go back and look at it today, and I thought, my gosh, that's awful. She paid me, you know, a pretty good deal, $2.50 a week in a free paper. And that's how it started. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of moved on from there, and I learned as I went. You know, I didn't belong to any writers' organizations. I didn't major in journalism, anything like that. But the opportunity she gave me to do it just meant so much to me. And then later, a few years later, I moved to Ruston, and somebody in Ruston had read the Homer paper, the Guardian Journal, and suggested to Tom Kelly, who was the editor of the later, Ruston Daily Leader, said, you know, you might want to see about getting Glenn Harris to write a column. So he contacted me. I did, started writing for the Leader. Same thing happened a few years later. Somebody suggested Streetport Journal didn't have a outdoor writer. And so put me in touch with Stan Tyner, who was the editor of the Streetport Journal. He hired me to do that, too. So it's just kind of been a growing thing from there. And then from there, it went on to, you know, trying my hand at magazines and so forth. And then eventually got into outdoor radio. And just been a fun thing, Greg. It really has.
So, and I tell you, Mr. Glenn, you have, and I just want to share this with you. Growing up as a little boy, during the summertime, I stayed with my grandfather, you know, when school was in and or out, and he was retired. And so he and I would piddle around the day, and I couldn't wait for him to go inside because I knew he'd got the news star. And I knew exactly where I was going to go when your article was published. And I mean, as a little fella, and, you know, Glenn Harris, you were a big deal. I don't know if you will say that because you're a very humble person, but in my eyes here, I mean, your name just, you were, like I said before, the voice and the words for what we love to do. And then you painted those pictures so well that, you know, and you know, you, I guess you could say, in my opinion, for my generation, I know Mr. Gritz was your mentor, but you were, to us, you're the godfather of all of this. I think everybody that does anything right here can always hone it back to Glenn Harris and what all you used to bring to it.
Well, and I've got to give credit where it really do. The good Lord gave me the ability to put stuff down in words that in that way that folks could relate to. And, of course, doing it over the years, it's improved. You learn stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And,
so it's just been fantastic.
Well, I'll never forget the first time I started writing. You know, we were doing a little thing on Bayou Bucks on the internet, and I emailed you. I didn't know your number. I didn't know anything. I found your email on the internet, and I emailed you. And you told me exactly that story about Mr. Grisham. You said, if you're going to be good at writing, you got to write.
That's it. You just got to do it. You can't just all of a sudden one day be a great writer.
No.
Because I was lousy. I ain't kidding you. So, but I had the desire and the burning in me to do it. And it's just... That was key. But again, like I say, the good Lord gave me the ability to do that. And I have been so blessed to do something. You know, here I am. I ain't young no more, Greg. Mm. But to be able to, all 50 years, to do something you absolutely love, can't wait each week to sit down and get to write another column, is a blessing that comes from on high, my boy.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. Yeah. You know, when I drove up in your driveway, and I do this before I do anything, whether it's write, whether it's do a podcast interview, or just whatever with somebody, I just say, Lord, please just give me the words to make this really something for this person. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily for me, but, you know, when I was riding over here, I thought about what you said, do you want me to meet you somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
And do you know why I wanted to come to your house?
Wow.
Because in all the years, has anybody ever come to you?
One person.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You, to do what we do, you have to go to people. Well, mm-hmm. It's time that somebody comes to Mr. Glenn and sits down and talks with Mr. Glenn. And I thought about that. I said, no, we're going to do this the right way. You know, if he's going to be my interview, I'm going to treat him just like he's always treated everybody else and give him that.
Well,
so I knew that.
I appreciate it.
Yes. So now let's go back to your, where were you born?
I was born and I grew up in the big city of Goldona, Louisiana, which is down in Natchitoches Parish. And I grew up with my daddy, worked for wildlife and fisheries. Mm-hmm. He was a predator control supervisor. He was a wolf trapper, they called him back then, back when they had red wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I developed a love for the outdoors. That segment of it, he took us hunting, took us fishing, and so forth, through my daddy. But then my mama, she was, she loved birds. She loved little creatures. And so we'd set out sometimes, my brother and sister and I, with mama, and we'd see who'd, she'd point it out to us, who'd see the first star. We'd catch lightning bugs and put them in a jar for a little while before we turned them loose. So I always say, and then if a bird, she heard a bird in the yard, she didn't know what it was, she'd go get her old ragged old bird book till she found it. So I always said, Mama taught me the softer side of the outdoors to go along with the hunting and fishing stuff my daddy taught me, worked with me. So I was blessed to have parents, you know, both ends of the spectrum, hardcore hunting, fishing, to the soft side that Mama gave us.
That's ironic, you said, because I've often wondered how, you know, I see you do a lot of softer things like the birds. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll even send you a picture and I'll say, Mr. Glenn, what kind of bird is this? Because I know you have a strong knowledge of that, and that's exactly where it came from. I didn't realize that. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, I just have always had over there is a whole bunch of bird books, mm-hmm. that I have. My daughter gave me that for Christmas, so... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm interested in birds just to know what they are. You know, if a strange one shows up, I'm going to go dig in my books and I'll find out what it is. And I see you looking over there at the turkey thing.
Yeah, that's...
That was... I accidentally got into turkey hunting.
Did you?
Back in 92, I believe it was. A fella, an outdoor writer friend of mine from Alabama, John E. Phillips, you see his name in all the big magazines, he contacted me one day and said, I want you to come over here to Alabama, go on a turkey hunt. And I said, John, man, it's April. You know them big old bream are bedded over here, and the bass are in the shallows. And I just don't know if I can leave that. And he said, well, I'll send you an airplane ticket. I got you a guide lined up. Got you all the camo clothes you need and a shotgun. I said, I believe that Brim can wait.
I think so.
So I went over there, and that old guy in that top picture up there called in the first gobbler that I ever saw. And I said right then, I never will forget that. We got over there, and I heard that thing gobble on the roof back there. I'd never heard one before. And then in a minute, I looked, and I saw that. I thought it was a white softball coming through the woods. And I said, that turkey, tell you, that sucker came up there strutting, drumming, and doing all they do. And I thought my shirt pocket was going to be ripped off. You know, my heart was beating so well. Killed that bird, and I made a vow right then. I said, I may never kill another, but I'm going to learn how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I have been blessed since then. I've got the Grand Slam. I got to kill turkeys in Alabama and Texas and Florida, South Florida. And then the ultimate one was to get to go to South Dakota and get my Miriams to finish up the Grand Slam. So
that's a beautiful photograph.
It's been a blessing. It really has. And
now, you and I talked, you know, several years ago. You don't do much turkey hunting anymore, do you?
No, I don't. I can't.
Yeah.
I just can't. Turkey hunting requires you have to hear him over you, you got to go to him. And I can't do that anymore. I'm old back messed up. So all I got is I can get to rely on my memories of the good hunts that I had.
And, you know, that's what a lot of people, you know, that don't do what we do, they don't understand about turkey fans on the wall and deer horns on the wall, is it's not necessarily just showing it off. It's when you are years past that moment, you can look back at that turkey fan. And you can tell me every aspect about that hunt.
Oh, yes, sir.
And that's what it is. It's memories. It's a memento from that shining star in our life.
Yeah. And kind of like that deer hunting. I had, it was a reluctant entry into deer hunting. I lived in Homer, and I loved squirrel hunting. I had a buddy that he and I would hunt together. Up until deer season opened, I'd lose my buddy. And he just kept on after me. He said, you'll go try deer hunting. I said, man, I don't know anything about that. I don't even have a gun. He said, you got a shotgun? Yeah. Buckshot? I'll get some. Anyway, I went with him up to Summerfield and to meet with a group. Bill Bailey is the guy that had the deer dogs. And so we got strung out on the pipeline that morning, my first deer hunt ever. And the dogs, they turned them loose out there, and I was listening, they dogging closer and closer. And about that time, a 10-point buck come busting out of the woods and hit that pipeline, run right in front of me, wasn't 15 yards from me. And I went, boom, 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 and he hit the ground. Well, my buddy, when he came up right to me, he said, Glenn, that's a good deer, but why'd you shoot him three times? I said, well, he was still standing up. He said, heck, you got to give him time to fall. I shot half his horns off. But anyway, that was my first deer. That was my introduction to deer hunting. And that's something else I don't get to do much anymore. Some of my hunting club members have, you know, suggested, well, come on, we'll set you in the stand. And, you know, if you shoot a deer, and I don't want to do it that way. If I can't do it the way I used to, I'm, again, going to just rely on the good memories that I've had down through the years.
Yes, sir. And you know, you got the turkeys. And I look back, you know, y'all, to paint the picture of his office, you know, it's an average-sized room. He's got built-in cabinets. And they are full of books and memorabilia and photographs. And then you go all the way to the back. And there's a 8-point shoulder mount, and that is a absolutely beautiful shoulder mount. I don't know who did it for you. And the 8-point, y'all, is roughly around 17, 18 inches wide.
He scored just a little under 140.
I was going to say he's probably a high 130s deer. Very, very nice deer. What'd you shoot that deer at?
I shot him with my rifle about 1 mile from here.
For real?
From where I was set. Yeah, but then we had a little hunting club just north of here, about 500 acres. And it was, again, a story. It was 98 when we had a big ice storm. I don't know, Ron, it was close to Christmas time. Mm-hmm. And I had finished my work, got all my columns in that I needed to do, and I had a little time. I told my wife, I said, I think I'm going to run and go sit on a deer stand a bit. Well, I went to my first stand, and it was already icing up. I couldn't climb. I'm scared to climb it. You know, the steps were all icy. So I said, well, I'll just drive around to the other one, and I can at least sit in that stand. Well, when I pulled onto that little food plot, little pipeline type thing, I looked down there and I thought, dang, how'd a cow get in this mustang? I got looking, he raised it. I said, that ain't no cow. He was eating my clover just before it really got bad. And Greg, my gun was in the gun case behind my seat. I was in my truck. I reached back there, got my gun, unzipped it, jacked the bullet in, rolled my window down, propped on the window. It was 271 yards, and I shot. He took off. I said, well, at least I've shot at a big one. And I went down there and got to looking. Just ain't no point in it. And about where he was, and I just happened to look over there. That sucker laid. I had put it. It was so far that the bullet stuck on the other side of 270.
It didn't even
come
juice.
Out. Laid him down.
Ivy doll. You know, that's ironic you say tell that story. I know that within all of your experience in writing about big bucks, you would probably say the same thing that I will say. There's a secret. Every hunter's got a secret, and that secret is they were in the woods when they killed it.
That's it.
That is the surefire way. You know, everybody's got their tactics and their strategies, but the number one thing that everybody's got in common is they were hunting.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of it is you just happen to be there at the right time.
Exactly. When it's your time to kill a big one, mm-hmm. It's just your time. It doesn't matter if you're riding up to your stand and you're in a pickup truck and he's down there at 271 yards. And, you know, the only reason you were there is because it had iced over.
Yes,
I mean, there's a lot of things that went into play for that moment to come together.
Yeah, now, if it hadn't been so iced, I'd have been climbed up in mud and wouldn't have seen the thing properly.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it happened. That was good.
Now, your dad was the wolf catcher, right? Wolf
he
trapper.
Was the trapper, yes.
Did you ever see a red wolf? Have you ever seen
one? Yeah, all kind of. When I used to go with him to run his traps when I was a kid, there'd be, you know, he all especially around like Wind Parish and Agus Parish where we live, and they were, you know, they were destructive.
Mm-hmm.
But he also kind of realized when the red wolf numbers started diminishing, he then began to work with them to try to save them, you know. And now, you know, what they have now are just in a enclosure or protected place over North Carolina, what few there are left. But, yeah, I had some great experiences with Daddy and all kind of fun things. In fact, one time, if I can tell this little story,
tell
one time
all.
I went with him to run his traps, it was a hot summer morning, dry, and there'd been a bobcat harassing some, so he had a trap for a bobcat. Well, we went up, and the way he did his traps, he would use about an 8-foot drag chain with a drag hook attached to it, and then the other end of the trap, and he'd bury all that, cover it just nicely. Well, we went there that morning, the trap was gone. He said, well, something got in it. Could have been an armadillo, skunk, coon, anything. No track because it was so dry. And he said, well, let's spread out. I'm going to go this way, you go this way, and see if you can find any evidence. So I was walking along there and probably got as close here to that chair. And I noticed there was a log there that bark had been knocked fresh off of. Now, what is that? And something caught my eye, and I looked. And right about 10 feet high was a big old bobcat sitting in that bush. I was fixing to walk under. And I don't know if I've ever been that scared in my life. That sucker was looking right at me. And I thought, Daddy, here he is. But I thought I'd fix and get slapped on the head by a big old bobcat.
If
but
you anyway, took a few more steps, you would have been.
Yeah, I would have. I sure would have. So it was fun. It really was a fun time to be out with him. I want to show you something here. Can I show you something?
Yeah, yeah.
Daddy was a trapper, and one time in the Natchitoches Parish, there was a report of a cougar. And so Daddy found his track, and he poured a plaster of Paris, of the track of that cougar. He didn't catch him, but the cougar stepped in his trap one day that it had rained the night before and then washed sand up on it. The trap didn't set. So anyway, that was the story of the Natchitoches Parish cougar, 1949.
1940. That is impressive, Mr. Glenn. Yeah.
Whoops.
So, now, have you always done the outdoor writing thing, or what did you do? You know, when you graduated high school, what did you do?
Well, I went to Northwestern, went to college, and majored in business education. I started out in business administration, but those accounting courses were too hard, so I switched to education because I could make it through. And I was just an average C student, got out to grad, glad to do it. And my first job was teaching school at Shongaloo High School up in Webster Parish. Mm-hmm.
Shongaloo. They got a pipe sunshine in Shongaloo.
Yeah, well, they just about do, yeah. But I was familiar because there's a lot like gold on this little town. But I think they dumped on me what was left. Of course, I was a business major, so I taught business, I taught shorthand, taught typing, and then they put me in some history class. It was fun. And that was, since 1959. That's a long time ago. Just last week, I ran into one of my old students.
Really?
Who I taught in the 10th grade. He will soon be 80 years old.
My word.
So, I ain't going to tell you how old I am, but I'm on the floor. But anyway, that was my first job. And then after that year, probably because I had to make a living some way, they paid me $257 a month, which was my salary for that. Then I got into sales, worked at a West Brothers store in Mansfield. Got a job up there, worked there a while. Hated it just because I was closed in there 6 days a week, daylight to dark. My old shotgun and rod and reel sitting at the corner gathering dust was no fun. And then after that, I sold insurance for a year. Then I took a civil service test and got a job. I took the test to work for the employment office, you know, one of those people that do that. But that position was already filled, but there was an opening at the welfare department in Natchitoches. And I went over and interviewed for them, and they hired me. So I thought, I'm working for the welfare, which I did for 30 years. I did that as a welfare worker for several years, and I went to graduate school at LSU and got my graduate degree in social work. Moved up, was supervisor for an office in Wynn Parish, and ultimately moved to Homer, where I was the head of that office up there. And wound up, then I've got a chance to come to Ruston and do this one, be the head of the office here, and wound up the last year they had needed somebody in Jonesboro. That's where I retired. That was 1992 like that. So that was my career, and while I was doing that, I was starting to do my writing business on the side.
So that would have been around about the time that I was probably late 80s, early 90s, when I was really honing in on your column and seeing what you were doing and, you know, the fishing updates, and you'd write articles on hunting. I'd love to see what, you know, because I was always a hunter. Mm-hmm. We did a little brim fishing, but, man, when you wrote something about deer hunting, man, I was zeroed in on it, and it's just... It's just been a good experience to get to, you know, you were very integral in a lot of people's lives. Do people ever tell you that? Have you ever thought about that, how much you've affected people?
Well, I hear it occasionally, but I take it with a grain of salt because I know me, you know, just a old country boy that doing something I love.
Mm-hmm. And all the years of writing, you have anything that stands out? Just really stands out to you like that?
I don't know if there's any one particular one. I guess probably some of the ones that I wrote that qualify. You know, I wound up joining the Louisiana Outdoor Writers Association. I joined the Southeastern Outdoor Press Association and the Outdoor Writers Association of America. And in the Southeastern and in Louisiana, I remember the first one, I got a plaque somewhere. They had a writing contest, Southeastern Outdoor Press. And I'd right after my daddy died, and I wrote a column about memories of my daddy. And I sent it in, you know, not any expecting to do anything. Well, one day I got in the mail a plaque. I'd won second place over the whole Southeast in my column. I thought, dang, how'd that happen? But since then, I've been blessed so much because I'm being an active member of those last two, Southeastern and Louisiana Outdoor Writers. I've won some awards, you know, some of them over on the wall, and it's just been a blessing. And getting to rub elbows with some of the real professional writers that have been doing it a long time has helped me so much. And maybe I've helped some of the younger ones myself, too.
You have. Trust me.
Well, I hope so. That would be my prayer, that I would be able to, you know, rub a little something off that I'd learned on to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. So who would... Of the famous outdoor writers and the guys that are, you know, like you were saying, something to really talk about, who stands out the most?
Well, of course, that's Chris Gresham. He was probably the original one that inspired me. But then getting to go to meetings and meet people like Homer Circle, the famous guy from fisherman from Florida, all kinds of them. Tim Tucker, Jim Cassidy, and I've just gotten to be dear friends with some of them. Like, I've got a buddy in Little Rock, Keith Sutton, that he is a well-known writer in all sorts of publications. He and I we've deer hunted together in Alabama. We made a bass fishing trip to Mexico, to Lake Guerrero, with all kind of stuff like that. So it's hard to pin down anyone because all of them have just been, because they've shared with me, they've helped me, they've given me suggestions and so forth and just inspired me.
It's interesting that you talk about the different places outdoor writing has taken you. I mean, did you ever think you'd see places like that?
No.
Coming out of Goldana?
Of course, it was partly because my two son-in-laws were career military people. They lived all over the world. I got to bass fish in Hawaii. I got to bass fish in Spain, in New England. And, and then that Alabama turkey thing was, I'd go back every year, you know, with this guide that guided for that first one. He and I got to be friends, and I went back there for several years. He's passed away now. In fact, I even had him here to come hunt with me here. But I'd go out there and kill turkeys in Alabama for several years after that. So it's just been, I don't know how I could have been more blessed than what this career has done for me.
It is really, you know, you have really, I didn't realize you'd gotten to do so much and be a part of so much. That is a very good life, let me tell you. That makes a great story.
Sure been a lot of fun.
Yes, sir. Well, you know, I see this double barrel shot. Is that a double? Yes, I see the double.
That was my shotgun that when I went to Alabama, killed my first turkey. That's a muzzle loader.
Oh, okay. That is impressive. I like that. That is a very unique piece of weaponry, man. That is gorgeous.
They had that there. They just, you know, they try to do something, you know, for like the muzzleload. That, I don't know, I don't remember what brand it is, but they promote it. You know, they want the sponsors to hunts like that.
You know, this the last, well, I would guess to say probably starting around 2009, 2010, in my opinion, the hunting world started to change a little because you had more trail cameras being run. You had social media. You had a lot of things that were promoting the outdoors. Mm-hmm. Have you seen a lot of change?
Oh, Lord, yeah. Yeah. In fact, last week, I don't know if you read my column last week where I talked about my 50 years at it, and how I started was a yellow tablet and a number two pencil and a gallon of whiteout. Well, first of all, I'd write it, scratch through it, and finally get the column I wanted. I had an old manual typewriter. I'd type it on it. That's where the whiteout came in. I just have to, you know, where now you just make a mistake, you just go back and correct it. But back in those days, you know, you had to go back and blot it out and try to do it right. But yeah, a lot of changes, and it nowadays it's almost gotten past me on technicality stuff. I know they, even in the Southeastern Outdoor Press, to enter a writing contest. You know, I used to do that easy. I just send them a column, you know, make copies like they wanted and enter. Now everything's got to be somewhere online. You got to jump through hoops that I just said, I ain't going to do that. I'm going to be satisfied with the ones I want.
So when you would, like back early days, well, how would you submit an article?
Oh, to the paper? Uh-huh. First of all, mail them.
You'd mail it. Mm-hmm.
When I was writing for the New Star, I would, before then, though, I would type it out, get it like I wanted to, take it to Scott Boatwright. Mm-hmm. He worked over there then. I'd take it to his house. And before then, I'd take it to Greg Hilburn's house.
I remember his name.
I'd take him the column, and he'd take it over there for me. And so that was, you know, had to make a run every morning to, or every one day a week anyway, to go get my column to the courier, mm-hmm. either Scott or Greg, to take it over there. And this is what simplified things so much.
Oh, yeah, the computer. Yeah.
I used to, like I told you, writing on the yellow tablet and a pencil, you know, it took me a while to realize that's just wasting a little time. I decided to give it a try, just type directly to it. And the more I've done it, the easier that's become. And so I wouldn't consider handwriting anything to start with now.
I tell you, you know, writing articles on deer, you know, when people kill a deer, you tell their stories. I started doing that in 2009 or 10. I think it was 2009. And all I would do is I just had a piece of paper and my pen, and I would just write, you know, the notes out on that. And then I, you know, I did that for like 2 years. And then finally, I'm like, man, there's got to be a better way. And I found an app on my phone that was a voice recorder. And that's when I started recording.
That's what I use now. I've got a little gizmo here. I will wear this thing out in deer season because hopefully they'll let me do it again. But I find out about, and I use the internet a lot, Facebook a lot. When people say, you know, killed a big deer, well, I'll contact them, tell them I write for Louisiana Sportsman, and they, you know, would like to do a story on them. And most of them are fine. They want to do it. They'll send me a picture. They'll send me their contact number. I'll call them. I'll record it on that thing, and I'll transcribe it here, write my story. That's the easiest thing. That's something I love. I did 40-something last season, I believe, and I'm hoping I get to do it again.
That's a lot of deer, Mr. Gunn. And they have to meet, not only is it just a lot of deer, that's a lot of deer that met the criteria.
Dang right. And it starts out, if he's not a 140-inch, I can't write about him. Then a little bit later, they say, we're getting too many of them, move it up to 150. Mm-hmm. And then 160. So by the time the season's over, I'm writing about some show enough big
some
ones.
Big ones, that's right. Well, by the time that comes in is when the east side of the state starts to come in along the Mississippi River, and that's when, if you're going to get one of those, that's where they're going to come from, nine
but
times out
just,
of ten.
I enjoy doing that. That's mostly, other than my newspapers, I write for, I think, 7 a week now, same column, but starts with mainly Rustin, but I write for Farmerville, Homer, Wachita Citizen over in Monroe, one in Winsboro, one in Gina. And then there's something else new that has just kind of come up is these journals that some of the, I don't know if you've seen them, like Shreveport Bossier Journal, mm-hmm. the Lincoln Parish Journal, and several parishes. Well, I write for four of those journals now, too, in addition to my regular newspaper. Mm-hmm. And so I know with the Shreveport, that's the big one that covers big, you know, they get a lot of readership. They do mostly sports stuff, but they wanted me. And my buddy old Teddy Allen that used to live here in Ruston, a well-known humor writer, recommended me for that. So I write for them every week, too.
Okay. Well, I tell you, that's a lot of publicity you got there, Mr. Glenn.
I know it. It's just a lot of I've reached out to lots of people.
What magazines have you written for?
Well, I have down through the years. I used to be my goal if I could make the big three, and I did. I've written in Outdoor Life, Sports of Field. What's the other one? Field and Stream.
Yeah.
Written for all them, written for Bassmaster, Turkey Call, used to be one Southern Outdoors. So, a good many. Mm-hmm. I've written one book.
Really?
And all it was I compiled articles, some of my favorite articles in a book about 15 years ago. Well, I'd like to do another one, but I don't know if I'm up to all that's involved. If I could just, they could take my columns and say, do this, could do this, and put it in a book, good. But then they want me to do this, you know, make sure this is right, check them all, get a picture with each one, and I'm not sure I can do that. But that was good to have a one book published.
What's the name of the book?
It is Talking Outdoors, I believe.
Is it still in print? I mean, could we, like, find it somewhere and buy it?
No, okay. It's out. They all, let me see, my wife probably has it covered with my award I won.
Yeah, he's got some plaques around, Excellence in Craft.
I won those three this year.
I see that.
Louisiana Outdoor Writers. First place newspaper, first place magazine short feature, and third place newspaper, so. That was down at Thibodeau just a few weeks ago.
I almost went, but I didn't know you were going, and I'm not a member of LOA. They sent me an invite, and they said, hey, you know, we're inviting non-members, you know, to kind of come see what we're about, and I was so close, but I'm like, man, I'm not going to know anybody down there. If I'd have known you were going to be there, I think Mr. Kenny went.
Oh, no, he didn't go this year.
Okay.
No, we got what we call the Pine Tree Mafia. That's me and Kenny and Terry Jones. Mm-hmm. And two or three years in a row, we all won prizes, and they'd get a picture of us. They called us the Pine Tree Mafia, I think it was.
Yeah, and I know, you know, I think the cool thing about being a member of that is you get to meet people all over the state who doing the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you can make contacts, and you can bounce ideas off people, and it would be beneficial, I know.
Yeah, well, you need to join it.
I know.
Get in there.
Mr. Kenny's been working on it.
Yeah, I have too.
I think you have.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have.
We need more because that's it. From North Louisiana, it's me and Kenny and Terry, and that's and well, Terry mostly does historical stuff. You know Terry can, Jones?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. And maybe I can get on Dusty McGee. He's starting to do a little writing,
I've been working
too.
On Dusty, too.
Yeah.
Because his stuff, he's good. He does a good job.
And you know, and if you look at his contents, just like what you were saying, if you're going to get good at writing, you got to write. And I think Dusty, each time, his articles are better than the one before.
And, I've been after Dusty and you. Mm-hmm. Y'all need to join us there because when I went, of course, we didn't have the Louisiana Outdoor Writers Conference for 2 years because of the COVID. And the one at Thibodeau was not very well attended. We just didn't have, it just discouraging a little bit. It makes you wonder. The Southeastern Outdoor Press that I've been members of, I'm one of the earlier first members of it, they're voting to fold or to merge with another one. So, because of lack of interest and lack of sponsors and that kind of stuff. And so it's sad to see all that sort of stuff happen.
Yes, sir. Well, let me ask you, we're going to end it up with this. You know, you influenced me as a young person, but it wasn't necessarily, I didn't realize it at the time how much you were influencing me. And I wish I'd have caught the writing bug before I did. So let's say there's a young person out there right now that admires, you know, things that they see on the internet with you doing or Mr. Kenny or Dusty or whoever, you know, and they're thinking, how do I start that? You got any advice for somebody?
Well, I've had people ask me the same thing, and I say, if you can do like I did, find you a little weekly paper and that will let you write, and you learn by doing. That's mm-hmm. it. That is the very best advice I could give somebody that, you know, there's some folks that maybe they say they want to write, but they don't have a natural gift for it. But there are others like you and like Dusty that I think are gifted. I think y'all have got what it takes to do it. To do it, you got to do it.
You do.
And do it
You're
regularly
exactly right.
on a regular basis. That was my one thing there with Homer is I had to have him something every week. And, I learned by doing. And then once I did, then joining the writers' organizations and getting to meet the real show-enough writers, you know, helped so much.
Well, you know that old saying, iron sharpens iron.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get around better, you get better.
Yeah,
that's where being a part of an organization like that would really come in handy, I know. So, Well, Mr. Glenn, I really appreciate you letting me come by here. And like I said before, you've told, there's no telling how many stories you have written about people. And it just was on my heart to let you tell your story in your own words.
I appreciate the opportunity. I really do. And again, I appreciate you for what I know in my deer writing stories that I do for Lutheran Sportsman every week. I appreciate you for, I can call you to find what about this particular guy and you'll give me the details on it, so you've been a help to me on that.
Well, I know how hard it is to track folks down sometimes.
Yeah.
It can be a booger bear to get people, and then not only get them, but to get them to talk.
That's it.
You know, some folks, well, and I love when they say this, and I know you've had this happen too. Well, it ain't much of a story. And then when you start peeling back layers of the onion, you're like, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, you're having to draw them out. I get somebody sometimes, well, I'm just sitting there, and that sucker stepped out, and I shot him.
I hear the same thing.
I say, okay, let's back up. You're sitting at that stand. What are you looking at? Are you looking at a thicket? Are you looking at a food plot? What time of day did this happen, you know? And then, too, you know, when he stepped out, had you seen any deer before then? Just try to build the story, you know. You have to put stuff together to make a story out of it.
And sometimes the longer you talk to them,
they'll
warm up, and, man, they'll just really start throwing information out.
They'll tell you more than you really need.
That's it. That's it. And then it takes so long to cipher through the information that they gave you to get, you know, 1,200 words or 800 words, whatever you're after. And it's just like, my goodness gracious. If you'd have told me this 20 minutes ago, I could have already been finished with the article.
That's right.
Well, but Mr. Glenn, I really, really appreciate you for this. It's great to come by and see Miss Kay. And, you know, and like I said, I'm looking forward to reading more stuff from you this year.
All right, buddy. Well, I'll be keep, as like I said in my 50-year article, 50-year anniversary article that as long as these fingers keep working, the brain don't quit on them, we'll keep doing it.
I love it. I love it. Thank you, Mr. Glenn.
Appreciate you, buddy.
So that's all for this podcast, guys. I hope you liked it. This guy is a huge part of my life. He has helped me out in more ways than I can think of. So the three takeaways from the Glenn Harris interview. Number one, be a mentor. Always strive to be a mentor. And guys, find you a mentor if you don't have one. Now, a mentor is just somebody that you're going to take advice from or give advice to. Now, look, folks, don't go to giving some unsolicited advice. Make it some legit advice that somebody's going to need some help with. And be that positive vibe in somebody's life. Number two, hone your craft. Whatever you're doing, I don't care if you're a lawn boy, if you're out there cutting grass for a living, or if you're an outdoor writer, do it the best you can be. I mean, sit down and say, I'm going to be the best at whatever I'm doing that ever lived. Hone your craft and own it, man. I'm telling you, that is the best way to advance in anything you're doing. And lastly, iron sharpens iron. Proverbs 27:17 says, as iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. Glenn put himself in position to be around people who were notable in what he wanted to accomplish. He got better, he bounced ideas off people, and therefore he has been doing it for 50 years successfully. That's all I've got for this podcast, guys. My name is Greg Hicks. This is the Antlers and Hicks podcast, and I want to encourage you guys to live life past 20 yards. I'll see you next time.